races for political office, that's governor, senator, county commissioner, or supervisor, and so on, those are the races that tend to get the majority of voter attention. Races for judge do tend to be a lot less sexy. A judge is not like a legislative or executive office holder. The job is narrowly defined. But several parts of our region are voting on races for judge or appellate court justice where there are multiple candidates rather than just the incumbent. And this gives us a chance to talk about trends in judicial races, which are seeing more tension and money over time. They're being monitored by, among other organizations, the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University, where Alicia Bannon is senior counsel. Her work focuses on judicial selection and promoting fair and impartial courts. One of her previous jobs was clerking for Sonia Sotomayor before she became a Supreme Court justice. Alicia Bannon, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
This must be fairly fascinating work. I notice, among other things, that there are a number of different ways of choosing judges across the different states.
There's kind of 50 states and almost about 50 different ways that states choose judges. The most common, so in 39 states around the country, there are states use some form of election as part of their judicial selection process. That includes contested races, which look more like, look similar to political races where you'll have multiple candidates vying for a single seat. And then you also have what are known as retention elections, and that's something that California, for example, uses for its appellate courts, where a judge is initially appointed but then stands for an uncontested yes or no vote, so the public can say, yes, we want this judge, or no, we don't want this judge to continue on the bench. In addition to that, there are some states where governors appoint the judges, some states where the legislature chooses them, and then there's various hybrid systems as well. So there's quite a bit of diversity in how states choose judges, but elections are a big part of the selection system for most of the states in the country.
And that is particularly true at the trial court level, it seems like.
Yes, so at the trial court level, in particular, there are more contested races. So it's more common at the appellate level for, there's still several states that use contested elections, including Oregon, but there's also, there are more states that use a kind of appointment retention hybrid. In lower courts, it's much more common to have these contested elections.
It seems that even in cases where there are the contested seats, though, particularly in Oregon, the tradition seems to have been that a circuit court judge will step down before the end of her or his term. The governor appoints the replacement, and then that person will stand for election in the next go-around. So it makes it a lot less like an open seat race, as you tend to get for the political branches. Is that fairly common?
No, it varies quite a bit by state. There are some states that are similar to Oregon in that. So, for example, Georgia, I think every justice currently on the court was originally appointed, even though it's a system that uses contested elections. There are other states, however, where the culture and tradition is that those seats, judges fill out their terms, and then when seats, those seats become open and you have a kind of full-throated contested election, complete with super PACs and attack ads and kind of everything that you might see in a Senate race or another kind of statewide race.
So super PACs and attack ads certainly make things exciting. But in general, though, I mean, up until recently, would you say judicial elections have been relatively tame affairs?
They were. I mean, so until around the year 2000, as a general matter, judicial elections were fairly low cost and sleepy. You know, there were a couple of notable exceptions. In California in the 1980s, three Supreme Court justices lost a retention election in a very kind of politicized anti-retention campaign.
Rose Byrd among them, I believe.
Exactly. Yeah. Rose Byrd and two of her colleagues. They were attacked largely for their position on the death penalty and the argument that they weren't they were essentially not upholding any death sentences within the state. Interestingly, if you looked at the money behind that attack, a lot of it came from business interests. So I think there were a number of reasons why those justices were targeted, even though the content of the campaign focused on their criminal record. And then in the 90s, again, you saw a few states, Alabama, Texas, where there started to be more kind of attention and money coming into particularly their Supreme Court elections. But then in around the year 2000, it really kind of took off around the country. So we just started to see a lot more attention being paid to races around the country. You know, a lot of the money typically came from business interests on the one side, typically in support of kind of Republican or conservative justices. And then on the other side, the left, it was largely coming from plaintiff side trial lawyers, to some extent from unions. And, you know, we kind of had an arms race where in particularly in states where there were courts that were kind of closely divided, where there might be an opportunity to shift the ideological composition of the court, to make it more pro-business, to make it more pro-plaintiff, you started seeing a lot of money coming into these races and a real change in their tenor. So as I said, you know, we started to see more attack ads. We started to see judges being targeted for, you know, decisions that they've made, particularly in the criminal justice arena. You know, and one thing that I think is particularly troubling is that there's a growing body of social science evidence suggesting that these kinds of election pressures are actually impacting how judges are deciding cases. So especially in the criminal arena, there's a lot of evidence that, for example, judges sentence more harshly in election years, that judges in states where we've seen a lot of television advertisements are more likely to vote against criminal defendants on appeal. So it's I think, a very troubling trend.
Alicia Bannon's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about judicial elections and increased interest, activity, and money involved in those elections. She's senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. If you have some questions, comments, or stories to relate about judge elections, please join us at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I noticed that you're one of the principal authors of a report called Bankrolling the Bench. I mean, how sharp an increase are we talking about in money going into judges' races over the years, Alicia?
Well, you know, it's basically looking at the decade from 2000 to 2009, so that 10-year period, 20 of the 22 states that have contested elections broke their state records. And now we're seeing in the next decade, we've already had, I believe, 5 states break records, including last year, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. There was a highly contested race for 3 open seats, which set an all-time spending record kind of nationwide. So it was more spending than we had ever documented in a state Supreme Court election. So, you know, it's definitely a trend that is, you know, that's expanding and continuing. One thing that we've noticed in the past few election cycles is that retention elections in particular have been becoming more politicized. You know, there have been examples in the past, so the Rose Byrd example is probably the most famous one of politicized retention elections. But on the whole, they tended to be very sleepy, very low cost, even as we were seeing contested elections become much more combative. But in, you know, the past few cycles, kind of especially coming off of a fierce anti-retention campaign in Iowa, where 3 justices lost their seats after a ruling on basically in a marriage equality case in the state, finding a right to marriage for same-sex couples. They lost their seat in a $1 million anti-retention campaign in a state that had not seen a cent spent on judicial elections before that. And after 2010, we've seen in several states each cycle more money going into anti-retention campaigns.
Given the money getting spent then, and you mentioned ads, attack ads going on, I mean, are they getting to be very much like the races for the political branches where you get, you know, so-and-so is soft on crime, wrong for Wisconsin or whatever?
You do. You know, in fact, soft on crime is one of the most common bases for an attack ad. We saw in this last election cycle a record number of ads touched on criminal justice themes. So either kind of attacking judges for being tough on or soft on crime, or praising judges for being hard on crime. A lot of that money came from outside groups. Interestingly, similar to the Rose Byrd election, if you look at the money behind those ads, oftentimes it wasn't kind of criminal justice groups, it was business interests or others who didn't have any kind of clear interest in criminal justice issues, but it's a wedge issue, and so it's something that's seen as effective in terms of, you know, trying to influence the public. You know, these are low information races, and so, you know, oftentimes what people are seeing in these ads might be the only thing that they know about these judges.
Low information, and I'm going to guess low turnout, too. I'm going to take a wild guess that the judicial races often get skipped on the ballot.
You're right. They are low turnout. They're kind of down ballot races. In some states, they also are held off cycle. So we've already seen Arkansas had its Supreme Court election in February. Wisconsin had theirs in April. And so in those states, you know, you have even lower turnout typically because they're not, you know, they're not geared to the main election day in the state.
Alicia Bannon, our guest, judicial elections, our topic. Here's a call from Bill in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, Jeff.
Hi.
I wanted to comment on here in Jackson County, Oregon. In recent years, we've seen a lot of young lawyers that are running against incumbent judges who have claimed to the public as part of their campaign that there's some kind of conspiracy going on between the incumbent judges and the governor's office. It kind of reads something like the incumbent judge retires at a time so that the governor will get to make the appointment. That's just a plain hogwash. That is not true. It's taking advantage of the ignorance of the public, and a lot of us resent that. There is no conspiracy. It is true that the judges do retire sometimes before the end of their term, and the governor does make appointments, and in my experience, in the many recent decades, the governor has made darn good appointments, frankly, better appointments than these open elections have been, if you really want my opinion.
Is the idea there, though, is it sort of a gentle person's agreement that I'll leave before my term so we can get an appointed position?
No, for a more low-key
election?
That's just plain not true.
Mm-hmm.
There is no such conspiracy. That's what I resent, is the young lawyer taking advantage of the ignorance of the public, claiming that there's a conspiracy when there is no such conspiracy. The judges around here have left the bench sometimes before the end of their term because of health or dying or those kinds of reasons.
Okay.
But not as a conspiracy with the governor's office. That's the part that I resent.
All right. Thanks for that, Bill. Appreciate that. So that gets back to what I was asking before, Alicia, about what seems to be a tradition in some places to leave before the end of the term so there can be a gubernatorial appointment.
So, I mean, I think there certainly are kind of different political cultures in different states. And so, you know, I'm not familiar with, the dynamics, particularly within that county that the gentleman was discussing. So I can't comment on that. I do know that if you look nationally, there are some states where kind of the overwhelming majority of judges on a court were initially appointed by the governor. In other states, virtually none were. So I think that does suggest that, you know, there are kind of traditions or norms in different places that vary. You know, I think one thing that tells me is that, you know, there's often a lot of debate about, you know, should we elect judges, should we appoint them? You know, I think oftentimes we don't put a lot of attention into rules around these kinds of interim appointments in states that use elections because, you know, they're not the formal way that the appointment system works. But in some states, that's how the majority of judges are getting onto the bench. And so I think that it in those circumstances, I think it does warrant kind of more thinking about, is this, are our interim appointment systems working as well as they could? Are there, you know, are there ways that we can, you know, address any concerns around, you know, kind of the risks of special interest influence in the gubernatorial appointment process or other ways to ensure that we're getting kind of good quality judges through that appointment process?
When we talk about the races for appellate courts, though, it becomes clear that this is another extension of politicization of so many things, that you're trying to get favorable votes or favorable decisions, in this case, from a judicial body. I guess it should come as no surprise when we're talking about having gone since February with a vacancy on the Supreme Court and no hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee to fill that vacancy.
I mean, absolutely, especially at the Supreme Court level, you know, judges play a tremendously important role in establishing the legal environment, the legal landscape in a state. And so, you know, I think there's good reason why we're seeing all of this attention by special interests on these races. It's because they're high stakes. You know, the who sits on a court is going to make a big difference in terms of the, you know, how business friendly a court might be. I mean, courts hear cases about, you know, everything from, you know, consumer rights cases, environmental cases, you know, cases around voting rights, redistricting, I mean, a host of issues that matter to kind of everyday people as well as to businesses' bottom lines and to the interests of kind of the political branches and political parties. And so, you know, they are high-stakes cases, and for that reason, we do see, I think that's a big reason why we are seeing this attention. You know, at the lower courts, we haven't studied that as in depth. I mean, in part because it's harder. There are so many lower courts around the country. You know, and anecdotally, and from what I've seen, I think often those races tend to be dominated by spending and contributions from attorneys, many of whom are appearing before those judges. You know, I think that's often, I think unfortunately, often seen as kind of the price of doing business before these courts is that you're expected to be contributing to judges' campaigns, and that raises a host of issues on in itself.
For the general public, for the folks who might normally skip that part of the ballot, what advice do you give for people? I mean, we do have voters' pamphlets in both Oregon and California. What would you recommend doing besides that to get an idea of who might be the better candidate for a judge opening?
It's a great question, and it's very important to vote. You know, I think some of the, you know, I think some of the biggest problems that we see in the context of judicial races is kind of voter apathy and lack of turnout, which can, as I said, I think helps foster some of the politicization that we've seen in terms of, you know, it doesn't take many voters to actually shift the dynamics in a court because so few people actually vote. You know, I think in addition to voter pamphlets, you know, many times bar associations provide rankings or performance evaluations of judges. So I think that can be a useful, you know, a useful way to learn more about the judges. And I think there's a real role for the bar and for the courts as well to be educating voters about kind of what courts do, what voters should be kind of thinking about when they are undertaking these elections. I know that there are groups like, for example, the National Association of Women Judges has a kind of good civics education program, which doesn't focus on the qualifications of particular judges, but I think provides a lot of information about kind of what the role of the courts are and what voters should be thinking about when they're casting their ballot.
Yeah, good thing to remember this or any election is that you might not care, but somebody else probably does.
Right. Very true.
Alicia Bannon is senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice. We've been talking about judicial selection and election here on The Exchange. Alicia, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Take care. At the bottom of the hour, we switch over to our Vent Stay segment, a regular feature of Wednesday on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Emily Curitan is just now joining me at the table with results of this week's survey. Our topics this week, this is your chance to vent your spleen on the $20 bill and who should be on it, and for Earth Day, toxic chemical use and how yours has changed over the years. 800-838-3760, the phone number, the email address, jx@jeffnet.org. We'll start with the money. The Treasury Secretary is expected to announce next week that Alexander Hamilton's face will not be removed from the $10 bill, as had long been proposed, maybe because Hamilton's so hot right now, a hip-hop musical about him having just won a Pulitzer Prize. Instead, two things are expected: a redesign of the back of the 10 with a mural of a collection of notable women, and a redesign of the 20 that throws out Andrew Jackson in favor of a woman, perhaps Harriet Tubman. We should point out that there is a recent musical called Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, but it was not nearly as popular as Hamilton. Don't know if that's a factor or not. So your vote, same as we asked on this week's survey, whose image should replace Andrew Jackson's on the $20 bill and why? And feel free to expand your focus to any and all denominations and offer appropriate images. Somebody you think belongs on a nickel, perhaps? Let's hear about it. 800-838-3760, the phone number on this Vents Day, our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Now to our Earth Day-themed topic, toxic chemical use around the house. Many baby boomers can remember our houses smelling really clean as kids. At what a cost. Between DDT to get rid of the bugs and harsh chemicals and the cleaners, we did and in some cases still do use toxic substances to maintain order around house and grounds. But many people have changed over to more earth-friendly substances. So here's the survey question. Name one chore commonly involving chemical use and how you get it done with extra regard for critters and the environment. 800-838-3760, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Emily, and we got a pretty decent response, some fairly charged responses, I notice, on the survey.
Yeah, good morning, Jeff. We did. It was, I was surprised, not an overwhelm. I mean, last week's survey sort of took the cake, over 100 responses. So this week we got under 20. That's still up on our Facebook, though. People, we could turn it around, folks. You can check Jefferson Exchange out there. If you like our page, then the survey will show up in your feed every single week. We did get some charged ones. I think I was a little bit unprepared. We sort of set it up by letting people know that the U.S. Treasury is expected to announce this week that a woman's face will eventually replace Andrew Jackson's on the $20 bill. We just asked people who they thought the lucky lady should be. Responses certainly ranged. Some people, of course, don't want to see any change on the $20 bill. Others offered their suggestions of women throughout history. Nobody completely flouted the suggestion and say went with a man of color or maybe a child, some other group that's completely unrepresented in American currency. It is worth noting, though, the $20 bill, I read this somewhere, not fact-checked, but sounds plausible that it's the most widely circulated bill in the world.
I would not be surprised, honestly, because you go into so many places where it says we do not accept $50 bills.
Uh-huh. 20
seems to be the top denomination you can break up. And it always seems like there's more of those around than there are tens anyway.
So it's really quite a staple of fame to have your face on the 20. And Old Hickory looks like he's getting the boot this week.
Andrew Jackson, although probably not off there till 2030 is what we're told in the preliminary things. The Treasury Secretary, Jack Lew, has not made the official announcement yet, but it is probably the worst kept secret in Washington. We'll talk more about that. It also reminds me, though, that ATMs, when you ask for fast cash, it's always in multiples of 20.
Yeah, right.
That probably helps the circulation of the $20 bills. We'll come back and talk more about who should be on the $20 bill and how you have changed the use of toxic chemicals around your house, your home, your lawn over the years to be nicer to the planet.